call the judiciary meeting to order. Thank you. We have Senator Wilkowski, Senator Costello, and myself, Senator Coghill. I think that's probably going to be the extent of our committee today. Today we're going to hear from the Alaska the Children's Justice Act Task Force, and I've already looked through your presentation. There's lots to do. So thank you for coming before us. We have Kari and Madison, who are in charge. So when you are speaking, introduce yourself, and then if you are switching back and forth on the presentation, just make sure for the record you're able to put your name on the record. It doesn't have to be a long spiel, but just say this is and say your name. Please, thank you for coming before us. Introduce yourself for the record, and if you want to introduce those that are with the task force, we'd be glad to hear that too.
Thank you, Senator. My name is Johanna Siebold. I am here on behalf of the Alaska Children's Justice Act Task Force. The acronym CJA is something we use a lot, and it's a lot less of a mouthful. So, and I'll turn to...
Yeah, thank you, Senator. My name is Jared Parrish. I'm the senior epidemiologist in the Alaska Division of Public Health inside the Maternal Child Health Epidemiology Unit, and we live in the section of Women's, Children's, and Family Health. And I'm also here on behalf of the Alaska Children's Justice Act Task Force.
All right. Thank you very much. Do you want to introduce some of the members of the task force that are with you, or do you want to have them speak later, or how do you want to? I see a whole room full of people for which they should at least be recognized for their work. So.
And I was actually going to, if I can go back.
Yeah, I'll get you back.
Oh, so if you're looking up at the slide, we actually have a list of all of the mandated members, membership disciplines that we have, and the folks who are here. So if we want to start with Judge Hugele, maybe
we
can introduce ourselves.
What we could do, just for just stand up, say your name, and the place you represent on this task force.
Charlie Hugele, I'm with the Superior Court in Kenai, and I represent the judiciary portion of the task force.
Thank you.
I'm Josh Flowers with Covenant House Alaska, and represent homeless youth.
Pam Carolunas with the Alaska Children's Alliance, and I represent the parents group.
Gail Gerges, I'm a retired prosecutor, but I still have some criminal expertise.
Good afternoon. My name is Kim Graham with the Office of Children's Services, and I represent Child Welfare.
Dr. B.J. Coombs, help with my...
Dr. Mike Hopper, psychologist from Fairbanks on mental health representative.
Hi, I'm Michelle Begich-Mock, and I represent individual experience in working with children with disabilities, Anchorage.
I'm Heidi Reddick, and I represent Division of Juvenile Justice and some of the law enforcement pieces that we're lacking right now.
First of all, thank you all for all your work. And please continue, Tawana.
Thank you. And as you can see, we have a pretty comprehensive group of expertise in here. And the reason we wanted to speak with you today is to simply provide you some information. We know that you guys have a lot of hard decisions to make. You've got some tight budgets. And we always figure that more information is always better than less information. And so having some of this information might help you guys when you're making decisions. And I think we also are more than happy to offer our expertise in any way we can to help you guys. So.
And from just the introduction of those who are involved in a task force, it's a real broad group of people that deal with issues that will find themselves into many bills in this legislature. So context is very important to us, and the focus of children's well-being also is. Thank you.
Absolutely. And our mission is to identify those areas where improvement does need to be made in statewide response to child maltreatment, particularly with child sexual abuse, and make such recommendations. So I think we're...
You can go ahead and move that microphone back and forth if you want.
All right, so I'm going to give a brief overview of some of the data that we have here about child abuse and neglect in the state of Alaska, and I'm going to be using some terms probably interchangeably like I think we always do, and we have this issue with terminology drift. And so when I use the word child abuse, often we're reflective of child maltreatment, which means child physical abuse, sexual abuse, mental injury, neglect. It's kind of like an all-encompassing term. And somehow child abuse has gotten into that type of all-encompassing term too. And so when we're going to be talking about physical abuse or sexual abuse, we'll try to qualify or quantify that a little bit.
So Jared, just for the committee members, if there's a place that you want to interject either a question or ask for some clarification, we'd be glad to entertain that. Is that true, Jared?
Absolutely.
And welcome Senator Kelly to the committee. We're just beginning the discussion from the task force on children's justice.
Yeah. Thank you. Thank you. Yes, I'm absolutely happy to entertain questions for clarification, however it might be needed. I can get on a roll talking about data because it's something that I'm passionate about and I really enjoy. And so sometimes I can get caught up in the nuances of how I get to one number. So if you're kind of glazing over, please feel free to interrupt me and get me stopped, get me reset or whatever. So the first thing I just have up here as a slide is that I think, Senator Coghill, you made a great statement at the beginning here saying that context matters. And it is absolutely true when we look at data, too. So because I'm a data producer, I'm really sensitive to our perceptions, how we make observations, and then how we utilize statistics to summarize these observations to inform, maybe contradict a little bit, or help reframe our perceptions. Because all of our perceptions are based on our own personal understanding and knowledge. And so when we consume a number, it's really, we have to put it in context somewhere within us and whether that makes sense or not. And so sometimes we might be immediately like, well, no, that can't be right. Because we generally value our own current understanding and then we try to reference that data within it. And I just have these two funny images up there to help kind of reiterate that with, well, however we're looking at the angle, we might be correct. But sometimes reframing it from another perspective can help us understand the context of the issue a little bit better. For me, the best one, and I spent probably an hour yesterday trying to see if I could see both the duck and the rabbit at the exact same time, and I couldn't. But if I actually had an image of a duck and a rabbit, I could see them both at the exact same time. And so context absolutely does matter. And when we're talking about child abuse and neglect or maltreatment, it's a really difficult thing to quantify. It's a hard thing to measure. Because usually it's happening in secret, it's happening in confines, and so we're trying to use multiple data points to help us understand this issue a little bit better to get a feel for what's going on. So I'm going to present a couple of different estimates here about disease burden, and what we might be looking at here is what's describing this issue. Now this is an estimate here that these estimates have been around for a long, long time, and these come from the Office of Children's Services, and this is the caseloads that they're receiving on an annual basis. And so this is the number of unique children that are either reported as evidence in the blue line, screened in, or substantiated, and it's by year from 2008 through 2015. And the interesting thing about this is that means that in 2015, no, this is on average, about 15,000 children are reported to the Office of Children's Services annually. Now, that doesn't count multiple reports or anything. That's unique children having at least one report on average. But you can see the blue line and the green line have both significantly had this upward trend over time. There's more reports coming into their office, and therefore they're screening in more. But the interesting thing about this, when you look at the substantiated line, it stayed relatively flat regardless of that increase. And so I don't have an explanation for that, but you could start making some hypotheses based on this little bit of data, is that it could have something to do with capacity to respond to that influx. It could also have multiple of other issues we could start thinking of. But this type of information lets us think about, wow, there's quite a few children in our population that are being reported where someone recognized something that said, I'm going to call the Office of Children's Services and let them do their job on this. And so this is one number. You can actually see the HTML on the bottom there. These data are publicly accessible, and you can query these data, and you can look at it by physical abuse, sexual abuse, neglect, and a variety of different ways to look at that as well.
So Jared, on this particular issue, we've got in the education community today, we were talking about mandatory reporting. And in the abundance of caution, probably people will report. So there's probably a scale between being overly cautious to under-reporting, right?
Yeah.
So the way we've looked at it, we've got a very broad mandatory reporting that has a civil liability attached to it if you don't. So my guess is there's probably a lot more reporting. Have you dug into that portion? Does that stat mean anything?
You know, I haven't dug into it specifically within our state, but I am abreast on the research nationally. And when we look at our state reporting laws, where we have very specified mandated reporters versus something like a state like North Carolina, where every person who's a resident of the state is a mandated reporter, the research is really mixed on the utility of having a broad law versus a narrow law and focusing in on them. And the idea or context that when you're going to be cautious, so you overly report versus I'm just going to ignore it and underreport, has been a really hard measure for people to nail down. But what we do know is that when we look at self-reported reports on through survey versus when we look at reports still underestimate what people self-report. And I'm going to show that a little bit later on when I compare three different estimates here.
Yeah, and just for me, worked on the Office of Children's Services off and on for issues down through the years. They do have a resource problem. It's been a continual plague to them. There's no doubt about that. So we know there's a tension there in trying to get to the most needy first. It's a triage problem. Substantiated is something that probably we hear a lot. Do you have a way to put that into a policy bubble for me that says it means this?
I would actually ask Kim Gui to answer that question since she's our child welfare expert.
Come on up, Kim. Please come on up so you can get on the record. And just go ahead and pull up that far chair there. And we might rotate people in and out of that chair, but just for the record, because we do record everything, just put your name on the record and then give us the answer the best you know how.
My name is Kim Graham with the Office of Children's Services, representing CJA Task Force today. We do have policy regarding what is substantiated. It could be risk of harm, and it's actually harm that occurs. We have a tool that we use, our workers use, that helps them drive to the decision whether we substantiate or not. And we modified how we were substantiating around 3 years ago, which could show why we're pretty stagnant in that line.
Okay, thank you. Uh-huh. Senator Wilkowski also has a question.
Yeah, just since you're the one actually in the trenches on this, this is a fascinating slide because the reports are up 30%, screened-ins are up almost 50%, and substantiated are down slightly or flat. So what's your take on that?
I think it's our policy change that we put into place a few years ago. There really wasn't a lot of direction to our staff about what risk of harm is and what harm was. And so we really did define it, and we're trying to be more concrete when we are looking at making a substantiated finding. So we really have tried to make more precise decisions on that.
Senator Wilkowski to follow.
Yeah, if I could. And I know we got a lot of slides, so I don't want to spend too much time. are you seeing people abusing the reporting process, or are you seeing that we are reporting process is too stringent? Are you seeing understaffed OCS? I mean, what are you seeing?
I do not think that we see a lot of underreporting. As a matter of fact, I think that there's a lot more going on out there than is being reported. We screen in around 51% of the calls that come into the Office of Children's Services. And as you see, we definitely have increased in our numbers of calls coming in, but we're still under the national average. I think the national average is around 55% of reports get screened in. So we're still screening in only 51 compared to national average, which is 55. So I think it's good that we're seeing an increase in our reporting because I do think there's a lot more going on out there. And while maltreatment is a consideration that we look at when we go out to investigate these, we also look at the safety. And so we don't have up here the safety numbers, but those are the children who are usually removed from their parents' care. And that's particularly important to us. Maltreatment, substantiation is important, but not nearly as important as the safety of a child. So that has also increased the number of children in care.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Thank you. Jared, to continue.
Yes, thank you. So for the sake of time and conversation, I'm sure there's going to be a lot of other slides.
Put your name on the record.
Jared Parrish for the record. So I'm going to move to the next slide. The other topic that I wanted to bring up here a little bit is the adverse childhood experiences. And now this is, I know that this is going to be on your guys' topic area, and maybe you're familiar with it or not. And I'm not going to go in great detail, but just a little bit of context about this is that this was a study that was done back in the late 90s, a joint effort between Kaiser Permanente and the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. Now, it was done at a large HMO of a pretty homogeneous group, so it was mostly older, middle-aged people that were employed that were highly educated. And what they did is they asked a series of questions related to abuse, a series of questions related to neglect, and a series of questions related to household dysfunction. And what they were actually quite surprised to see was that about two-thirds of that population reported experiencing at least one of those types of stressors in their life that would create a negative environment for health and development. And so after they identified this, among this highly educated, very homogeneous group, is they started looking at health outcomes. And what they found is that the more of the accumulation of these adverse childhood experiences that you have, that they've coined these as, the more likely you are to have a variety of negative health consequences in your life. And that includes things like drug use, cancer, early death, alcoholism, and you can see the words up there. And now there's an emerging science that's supporting how this is causal etiology, potentially. Like, how are we getting from the stress world to these things that seem kind of unrelated? And that's where we're seeing a lot of this brain science and neurodevelopment research being developed to help explain how this relationship can exist. But the point of this is that they've seen this over and over again, and there's been a ton of studies that have corroborated this, and this is moving from science into more knowledge base, where it's being confirmed again and again. What happens early on in childhood affects what happens to you in adulthood.
So could we go back one slide, Jared?
Yes.
And just run through the bars that are 0 through 5, just for those who get to listen in on this discussion.
Absolutely. So the graphic on the right-hand side of the slide that I'm looking at, on the bottom side, on the x-axis, 0 means you had 0 of these adverse childhood experiences, the individuals reported none of them. 1 is you reported 1, 2 is reported 2, and so forth into this. And so you can see that only a third of the population reported experiencing absolutely none of those adverse events, which include, for clarity's sake, too, in abuse, that's physical abuse, emotional abuse, sexual abuse. And for neglect, that's physical and emotional neglect. And with household dysfunction, it's mental illness, having an incarcerated relative, the mother was treated violently, so your intimate partner violence, substance abuse, and divorce.
Let's take it at ease for a second. I need. So just on this slide, the cohort was that professional group that you talked about. And was there an age group dynamic in there as well?
I'm sorry, what?
Well, this is a cohort of people that you said were professionals, I think.
Yeah. Yeah, so they were all like around 57. I mean, the mean age was 57 years old, and so they were older individuals, and they were recalling their experiences when they were before the age of 18, so their childhood experiences.
Probably time for reflection, because if you had asked me those questions at 22, they would have been very different at 50.
Yep, you know, exactly. So. And that's precisely why we're going to be talking about another data source that we've created in the state to help us understand precisely that issue with these data, is that recall can influence our memory a little bit.
Sure. Senator Kelly has a question.
So your different categories there, do you have examples of definitions like what is... substance abuse, is that fairly well defined as... physical abuse defined, I guess you've got divorce there, but for that is, do you have definitions for this?
Yeah, Senator Kelly.
And the other question was, have those changed recently? Did any of them change around 2012 where you have that uptick?
Thank you, Senator Kelly. Through the chair, so these were actual survey questions that were presented to these adults, and so they provided a survey question, so it was actually the adult who interpreted how that question was presented to them. And these questions have been asked here in the state through our behavioral risk factor surveillance, and so the questions have remained constant that have been asked when we're asking adults to recall their childhood experiences. And so this is separate from when we're looking at the OCS data, where we're measuring the number of kids that are being reported to screened or substantiated. Does that help?
Thank you, Jared. Please continue.
Okay. All right, so I'm going to skip this slide since we moved through this one already, just so that early childhood exposures that cause negative life stress result in a lot of negative health consequences that, from a public health professional, public health perspective, are things that we've been trying to work on and prevent for quite a while. And that's why the public health world has really started honing in on these adverse childhood experiences, on how we can tailor our interventions to prevent a myriad of negative health consequences. So we're lucky in the state of Alaska to have a lot of data related to ACEs. And I say ACEs, but I always think the hockey team, but it's adverse childhood experiences. And what I want to point out is that, again, we have another resource. The Mental Health Board has invested quite a bit of resources for us to get some good estimates on this, and Pat Sidmore has been instrumental in getting these data available. And so you have the URL to that website, and there's a screenshot of it right there to go and to poke around, because he has a variety of presentations that could fill this hour and a half and then some, learning about our population, our adult population, on what they recall during their childhood. And so what you can see on this this bar chart on the left is that these are the adverse childhood experiences that they were recalling. And you can see in our population, 33.8% on the bottom bar reported substance abuse in the home, 31% having some form of emotional abuse, 32%, that's out of order, had a loss of a parent, mental illness in a home, and you can see it all the way up to having an incarcerated family member, about 11.5% of our population. Now, what's important about this is that when we look at this about those who report four or more of these adverse childhood experiences in our state, they're 49% more likely to be unemployed, 274% more likely to be unable to work, 92% more likely to earn less than $20,000 annually, and significantly more likely to report poor physical and mental health.
Senator Wilkowski has a question on that point.
Can I ask a cause and effect question here? So just the $20,000 or less per year, are people with, is it your opinion, or I guess anyone that might be able to answer it, is it your opinion that those who make less than $20,000 per year, just choosing that one as an example, are more likely to have these? Does the wage or the income lead to the adverse childhood experience, or the adverse childhood experiences lead to these things?
Senator Wilkowski, did I say that
Wilkowski.
Right? Wilkowski, through the chair. That is an excellent question there, and that is the challenge of having a cross-sectional study where both the outcome and the exposure are measured at the exact same time, so you can't actually untangle causal etiology on this. But there is other research that it's really hard to untangle the low income and some of the reports on neglect, and sometimes that gets a little blurred for people. But I can't answer directly to whether it works both ways. Like if it's the low income that relates to these, it's probably a mixture of the relationship that's going on.
But this, Jared, the stat that's here says 92% are likely to, which means that's an outcome problem.
Right.
And the causal effect of that, for example, if we gave everybody $50,000, may not change if they had the four plus adverse effects.
Right. Right. No, absolutely. And again, they're self-recalling their exposure before their 18 years of life. So the idea there that they're measuring is that this early exposure then does cause or lead to or more likely to result in this outcome. But again, because both are measured at the exact same time, you can't emphatically state causal along that. But yeah, I think there's a lot of things that we do in this. I mean, we're quite frankly, we're using very blunt instruments to measure a very complex issue. And so, you know, there's a lot of things that we find associations with that are indicators of a relationship that I think one really strong relationship that the literature has shown again and again is that unmarried mothers are more likely to have kids that are involved in the child welfare system. So if we apply the causal etiology model, we should just go get everyone married. Doesn't quite fit. And yeah. So, but it's an indicator that maybe the moms has a more stress going on. There might be some unrelated partners in the home. There might be some other things going on. And so it identifies a population that maybe we can go and provide assistance and supports to.
So Senator Costello also has a question he wants to chime in on.
Thank you. Appreciate you being here today. My question has to do with, are there any studies out there that show the link between adverse childhood experiences and performance in school? Obviously, I'm a former high school teacher, and obviously having had that experience, you can almost see these influences affecting how students do in school. And then my second question is, does your group provide any recommendations to the education community? Something I've been interested in for a long time is for teachers to be educated on what trauma-informed care is. Is that something that you move into, or is that further in your slideshow?
Senator Costello, through the chair, I think that those are two excellent questions, and I would actually like to defer to our education representative, if you're willing to speak to that. We have such great resources on the CJA task force that we can, when a question comes up, so.
Put yourself on the record and then go ahead and address the question.
So Nichelle Begich Mock, and I actually am a principal of three schools in Anchorage, and so I do work for the Anchorage School District. And one of the things we just met last week about trauma-informed care and bringing us all the non-traditional schools to the table and starting there with how do we get that information out to our schools, to our teachers, to our staff, to really bring us up to where we need to be for our youth. One of the things we've also done is youth mental health first aid training throughout our district, and that just gives our teachers and our staff members another tool to use within our schools. We have so many youth that are experiencing mental health challenges and really going from that perspective. So we just started that work, and we're so glad you asked.
Senator Costello, to continue.
Do you mind sharing with us what schools that you work with? And then also, I've also been very interested in having more state agencies have a presence in our schools. Is that something that is possible? I mean, do you see that as a way to address some of the clients that are clients for multiple agencies that are all in our schools?
So the three schools that I currently am the principal of are McLaughlin Youth Center, New Path High School, which is located in the Anchorage Correctional Facility with a satellite site at Highland Mountain, and then Avail High School, which is located downtown under the parking garage that also has a satellite classroom at Covenant House and a night school program, Aspire. So I have quite a few schools. I've been in the district 25 years. I always use state agencies within my populations and have encouraged the other schools. We actually at Avail have Anchorage Community Mental Health Services in our schools with a grant that was provided from the SAMHSA group, the AWARE grant. And so we actually have mental health right in our school. For our youth and for any of the youth that we can reach from there. So Step Up, which is another one of my programs. So I am a proponent of all using resources in a way that can combine so that youth, it's not just about academics, right? It's about the wholeness of the youth. And in order to get to the academics, you've got to be here getting to the shelter, the food, the whatever, and then the mental health challenges that our kids experience, and then we can get content in, right?
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you very much for your work and your testimony. And it is true that in many schools we have special needs kids that they get a cadre of people around them that put a plan together. And that would be nice if every student could get that. It's just probably economically not likely to happen. But under the IDEA law, that is one that pushes that along where you have an individual learning plan that can happen. So there are different variations of that for excellent students, but if you happen to be like me, just an ordinary bum that just needs to get their attention got, you probably won't get it. Please, Jared, continue.
This is, for the record, this is Jared Parrish again. And Senator Costello, through the chair, there is ample research that indicates that kids that are experiencing multiple adverse childhood experiences have poorer educational attainment. I'd like to transition a little bit now into talking about this new novel concept that we have in this. Well, I guess the concept isn't novel, but the way that we're implementing and measuring it is that it's reframing this from taking a retrospective look and asking adults about their adolescence and their childhood, but instead taking a life course perspective and really understanding that early development and our childhood can set forth our trajectory. And that's, when I say trajectory here, I'm meaning our health trajectory and overall health trajectory. And when you look at this little graphic, when we think about a health trajectory at birth, there's going to be things that are going to support and lift you up and help you develop a healthy lifestyle. And that might be things like parent education and having some parents that have health literacy, parents who understand age-appropriate discipline and how to support you along that way, and being involved in preschool. But there's also going to be things that are going to be pushing down, that are going to be deficits that are going to reduce your overall health trajectory. And that could be things like being born into poverty because you might have less access to a variety of different systems, lack of healthcare services, and this concept of toxic stress. And now the important thing is that kids might be born immediately into different health trajectories based on their family situation they're being born into that time. And so the safety net that we try to develop within systems, within communities, and within and bolstering families are the things that try to lift up that overall health trajectory, because what the research is continuing to show is that the earlier we intervene, the bigger potential effect you can have. If you think about an airplane, if they're off 1 degree, right, you know, if you only go a short distance, that's not going to put you that far out of the way. But if you go over a long distance, you're quite a distance now from your destination. And so having those repeated touches at different age trajectories can potentially reduce that overall missed target of our trajectory. And so under this life course perspective, from a public health perspective, we've been really interested in trying to measure the lifetime risk or burden of exposure to these adverse events as they're occurring developmentally wise, instead of asking adults how they recall their childhood. And again, it's not that saying that one is bad, it's just to provide another context to this issue.
Please continue.
So this new emerging resource that we have is what we've done is we've taken resources that we already have in the state and we've integrated them. And what we've done is we've leveraged the power of the Alaska Pregnancy Risk Assessment Monitoring System survey, and that's called Alaska PRAMS. Now, this is a federally funded survey that we've been conducting in the state of Alaska since, I think, the late 80s. And it's an incredibly robust survey that's conducted in nearly all 50 states in the U.S. and some other jurisdictions. And what it does is it samples annually about 1 out of every 6 live births that occurs. And it asks the moms about their pre-birth, birth, and shortly after delivery experiences, and asks them a variety of different things related to health care and substance utilization and exposure to different trauma. Now, this survey is administered 3 to 6 months after the delivery of a live birth, and it's bimodal. So the first they get a letter in the mail, and then they get phone follow-up. And moms who respond to that survey provide implicit consent to have their information integrated with other information the department has on them. Now, this is an incredibly important fact because in other areas of the nation, in California, Texas, and in Florida, there are studies going on where they're integrating their entire birth cohort with their child welfare system. And while you can get some pretty neat information from that, you don't get the richness that you can get from the Alaska Pregnancy Risk Assessment, nor have those moms necessarily provided consent to having that. So what we've done is we've taken the 2009, 10, and 11 respondents from the PRAM survey, and we've linked those with a variety of different data sources that we have in our health department, including child welfare. And the goal of this is to follow this group over time through data linkages, not for the sake of looking at them individually, because we're not looking at that. It's to look at aggregated information and patterns so that we can inform our prevention efforts and target them and utilize the limited amount of resources we have most effectively. And so this is, there's no other place in the nation that is currently doing this, and we're leading this by leaps and bounds. There's multiple states that are interested in this, and I'm right now working with the state of Oregon, and primarily because we have a 3-year follow-up survey to PRAMS called CUBS, so we actually have measures at birth and we have measures when the child's age 3 that we can also integrate with this, and the state of Oregon has a 2-year follow-up survey as well, so we can actually then start talking about comparability because we're unique here.
And so it's 9 to 11?
So it's the 2009, 10, and 11 birth cohort. And okay. So it's kids that were born in those years, and so it's 1 out of every 6. So it's roughly about 1,500 births each year. And now the interesting thing about PRAMS is that it's weighted to our birth population. So when we talk about estimates, we're estimating from the birth population using those complex weights.
Okay, thank you.
Yep. And the name of this resource, we call it the Alaska Longitudinal Child Abuse and Neglect Linkage Project, or ALCAN Link. And we weren't trying to go for ALCAN, it just happened that way. And the only people who actually find that funny or have any meaning are people in Alaska, because when I talk about this nationally, they're like, oh, okay. But to me, you know, when you think about it, it connects us to something that maybe we haven't been able to measure very well. And so I think that's an important thing for us to consider. So what we've already learned from these data, by following a birth cohort, not just an annual sample of kids age 0 to 17 in a given year, we're following these kids over their life. What we found is that before the age of 8, 32% of kids born during those years will have at least one report to child welfare. 27% will have at least one report screened in, and 10% will experience a substantiated report to OCS. So when we think about this in context from a child's perspective, instead of looking at it from an annual perspective, where we're looking at all the kids in our current state, there are potentially a lot more families and kids that potentially need some additional services and supports than we originally might be led to believe if we only had our annual prevalence estimate. And this number, when I first measured this using this cumulative incidence, so you can see how it's growing over before the age 8, because if you have your initial report, then we count you as one, and you're only counted once, and then we keep following the cohort, and then if another one comes in, we count them. And you can see how the line is a little steeper. Let's just hone in on the black line for a little bit for the report. It's pretty steep during real, you know, when they're right being born. So that first year of life, there's a lot of reports. And you know what? You might be exposed to a lot more mandated reporters, and so they might be calling more. Then it kind of flattens out. Then you see this little teeny bump around age 6, too, which I'm starting to research and look into. It's like, oh, they're education, so they might be getting into some mandated reporters again. And so, you know, these might be a little bit susceptible when people have eyes on them, but it's giving us a perspective that, wow, this number is a lot higher than I had anticipated. And I checked, rechecked, sent it to researchers at UNC and was like, guys, is this right? And this is holding up that we're seeing this in our state. This number is the first time this has been presented. You're the first people to ever see this. I just did this last week. And what I did is that I was interested in not just looking at the 2009, 10, and 11 birth cohort, but I took the 2008 through 2015 PRAMS birth cohort. And I said, okay, well, if you were born in 2008, before age 2, what proportion of those kids were reported to child welfare? And I wanted to do that for each year and say, has it been changing? So is a kid born in 2015 less likely to be reported before their second birthday than a kid born in 2008? And, you know, when I looked at this over the duration of time, aside for two little blips that aren't statistically significant, no. Kids born in our state appear to have the same risk to be involved with our child welfare system or having contact with it than kids who were born, you know, 10 years ago almost. And so there's some area for us to be thinking about generating some hypotheses on things that we could be doing to support our families a little bit more. So so here I'm putting all these three data sources together right now to talk about maltreatment burden here in context. The first image on the left is the annual prevalence estimate as measured as reported to child welfare among our child population in an average year during those years from 2012 to 2015. And in an average year, approximately 10% of the child population is reported to OCS. And so when you think about it, that's from 0 to age 17, about 10% of that group. And so you might have some one-year-olds in there, some five-year-olds. But, you know, the five-year-old might have been reported as four the year before, but we're only capturing them that year. So it's really a snapshot on the actual new burden that's coming into to OCS. It doesn't necessarily reflect the child burden that they're experiencing along their lifetime. Whereas the cumulative incidence, or this lifetime burden measure, is actually doing that. It's measuring that over their life course, before age 8, 32% of kids are going to be reported or have a contact with child welfare. And when we look at the adult prevalence, this is asking parents to recall, or adults to recall, their history before age 18. And you can see that 34% of them reported some form of physical, sexual abuse, physical neglect, emotional neglect. And that number should match on to the cumulative incidence measure a little bit closer, because that's a recall of your lifetime burden. And what we're trying to measure on the cumulative incidence is your lifetime burden. Now, the reason why I'm focusing a little bit on reports, and that in no way means maltreatment or neglect or abuse. I want to be clear about that. But from a public health perspective, we're often really interested in identifying sentinel events that we can start intervening on. You can think about this in the medical world. If you detect, if something's detected, like a lump on a woman, they might go on and find out it's benign, but you might find a different trajectory that you're going to watch that a little bit closer, because research suggests that if you find or detect those types of sentinel events, we want to put you under closer observation or provide you supports or change maybe some health habits and things like that. And so from public health, we're really looking for those sentinel events that we can start focusing in on intervening on. And the research has continued to show that children that experience a report look much more likely, much more like kids that have a substantiated report than those who don't experience a report over their lifetime.
First of all, that's a huge number. And then secondly, that 34% probably has a pie all of its own on what those segments look like.
Yeah.
Is that something that we'll be seeing today, or is that something to come?
It's not, Senator Coghill, thank you. It's not today in light of time. And one of the challenges that I often have is that the way we consume information and numbers, there becomes this point of information overload and number overload. And so for the sake of just kind of getting a context for the problem, I decided to keep it a little bit on this side.
But that will have a question mark lingering over our heads, I can tell you that.
So, you know, I did throw this slide in here that does break out neglect, physical abuse, and sexual abuse. And I think that's what you were getting at, actually. Wow. I did this one, too, last week. So.
Oh, I have a question.
Oh, before we move on, though, Senator Costello has a question.
Thank you. And on these graphs that you're showing us, do you have information by region of the state, or can you comment on, is this occurring in certain regions over others? Can you make that kind of a blanket statement?
Senator Costello, through the chair, I do have some information by region, and I didn't bring that to present on here, and there are differences that we see by region. The interesting thing, though, that happens by region, and I'm going to make a little touch on this. When we think about, usually when we think about region, we're thinking about disparities between regions, like some region that has a higher event versus some other region. Usually for the sake of numbers, we compare to the Anchorage area because just the mass of it and that denominator is real nice to use. But when we're able to control for, or we create models where we adjust for factors that we know to be associated with maltreatment or these events that are modifiable, we see that disparity or difference between region or difference between race really attenuate. And so it ends up not being who you are or where you are. It's this disproportion of burden or factors that you're being exposed to that are modifiable. And so you can think of like substance abuse, mental health, and lack of services. So the regional areas that we see where we have some disparities are areas where we continue to see a lot of different disparities between our northern and our southwest regions. Yeah. Regions continue to have estimates that are above that when we compare them to Anchorage.
Follow up.
The reason I'm asking is because I recently was visited by a member of the Violent Crimes Compensation Board who provided me with their annual report, and I'm not sure if you've looked at it, but it's very interesting because when you go through the recipients and who they're helping and what the crime is, when you get into some of the rural communities, the graphs that show that the recipients are children they're much higher than in the more populated areas. And I think that is very interesting. I was just wondering if you have any connection with the Violent Crimes Compensation Board. I noticed that they weren't actually on your list of individuals, but just wanted to throw that out there. If you haven't seen their report.
Yeah, no, thank you, Senator Costello, through the chair. I'm aware of them, and it's probably come through my email at some point, and it's one of those things that I haven't fully dived into a little bit. We are trying to look at the regional analyses a little bit closer. The challenge is that right now I run this program that I developed. I'm over the birth defects registry as well as our child death review, and so when I split my time, when I'm doing one thing that's important, I'm not doing these other things, and so we're trying to get information out the best we can, but that's a great one, and I continue to get asked about region, and I can put that on my priority list.
Thank you, Jared.
So I just have a few more slides here that I wanted to talk about. So just to reflect back now on that ACEs slide that I shared with that image that had the abuse column, the neglect column, then that household dysfunction column that was just kind of like, I can imagine these researchers, because I'm a researcher, and sometimes you get this stuff and you're like, fuck. what am I going to do with this stuff? What are we going to put these in? Well, let's just call that household dysfunction. And so the different things that go into it are things that we actually measure on prams, or very similar, that we ask moms 12 months prior to birth if they experienced any of these events. And that includes things like being homeless, husband or partner went to jail, being in a fight, loss of job, even though they wanted to keep working, husband or partner lost their job, having arguments with their partner more than normal, having a very sick family member, being separated or divorced, moving, and you can read the rest. So what I decided to do is like, well, let's look at household dysfunction before a kid's even born into this world and see what the relationship is with contact with child welfare. And what we see is that the more household dysfunction that a mom reports, the more likely it is that a kid's going to have contact with child welfare. Kind of a no-brainer when you start thinking about it. But this is data that we've never seen before or never had. In fact, this relationship is interesting. When we looked at moms who reported four or more, we identified that 21% of moms reported experiencing four or more of these events. And we actually found that kids that are born to moms reporting four or more, one out of every two will have a report to child welfare before the age of eight. So 50%, which is a shocking number. But from our public health perspective, it's starting to be like, oh my goodness, bells and whistles are going off. Before a kid's even born, we can start helping support a family to have a child brought into their home to potentially reduce that a little bit. So there's some things that we can start doing and thinking about prevention before a kid's even born. And from a public health perspective, that's nice. And I know that CJA task force is really not focused in on prevention, but because I wear both those hats, when I start thinking about this, I'm really excited. But then it's also when we're doing intervention, so we're doing teen dating, pregnancy, all those sort of things, and teaching about that type of health, as well as whatever we're doing for responding to child welfare, we're going to be preventing potentially for that next generation if we can build these types of things in there.
Thank you. Yes.
So I think this is my last slide. Hope it is. But I started off saying that this is a complex issue, and there's a lot of factors that can contribute to what could put a family potentially in need of some extra supports. And one of the things, and I'm glad we've already talked about education, is that I had wanted to look at this idea of education, and on the when I was looking at kids that were born to moms that reported less than 12 years of education completed, now we're using that as a proxy because I don't have, did you complete high school, yes or no, we just have this number. And so when I looked at kids born to less than 12, you can see they're in the red line. And so the higher your red line means the higher the incidence proportion of being reported to child welfare. And the blue line there is kids that were born to moms with 12 or more years of education. You can see this huge divide. And so kids that are born to moms that have less than 12 years of education are 3.5 times as likely to be reported to OCS before age 8. So when we think of protective factors, education is definitely falling in that world. However, it's not just one thing. There are protective factor killers. And one of those protective factor killers is intimate partner violence. When we looked at the intimate partner violence a little bit closer as reported on PRAMS, we found that if we interject intimate partner violence into that low-risk group of moms who have 12 or more years education, it completely obliterates that protective effect, and they have the kids born into that environment have the same risk as those born into less than 12 years education. And so, again, it's not who you are. It's potentially the disproportionate burden of things you're experiencing that are putting you at risk. And so when we think about how we're intervening on this is that it's not just – I don't think we're going to be able to target just one thing. I don't think we're going to be able to intervene in just one place. And when we're going to build protective factors, we all have to be thinking about reducing the barriers or things that are pushing them down. And this education thing is something that I'm really excited about because so much good is going on in the education. But we do have data barriers in sharing information. There's a FERPA law that is difficult with HIPAA law. And when we think about if we could interject some of their data into this data that I'm creating for this longitudinal cohort, we could start looking at educational attainment, educational outcomes, and we could look at these populations to inform our decisions a little bit more.
I will only say that education certainly is going to be a part of the solution. I think most of us know that. It's just how. And this is one of those things where heavy-handed mandates can sometimes blast more than they can help repair. So Those are areas where I kind of watch intently because, you know, first of all, we want to make sure they're safe and well-educated. And then the social service needs beyond that then can happen. But we've got probably a whole range of other possibilities from helping with young parenting skills to a variety of other issues that the communities continually try to put into place for their community needs. So I'm reluctant. So my partner and I here would probably argue over how much should go in schools, but it probably is a healthy argument. So,
Senator Coghill, thank you for the comment on that. That's you know, it's important. There's got to be diversification on how we intervene with a lot of these things, and education in the literature has continued to show to be a nice protective factor. We help set them up for their future to make informed decisions. But there's a variety of other risk factors that are out there and protective factors and populations. And for the sake of simplicity and having a clear message, I didn't present a lot of the statistical models that I build and put a lot of formulas in here to talk about the fancy math, because at the end of the day, when it keeps coming down to these things, the substance use, the mental health, and providing some of these safe, stable, nurturing relationships continue to rise to be independent relationships in these variables. And so you're right, the devil's in the details on how you actually execute some of these things. And so what we're trying to do in public health is develop resources and data sources that can help inform our decisions.
Very helpful. So we can go on to the next slide, because I'm kind of lusting after the last few slides you have. So.
I am done, and I will turn it over.
Wow, and this is Hannah Siebold, for the record, and I guess the lusting after this makes it feel, I wish I had a lot more answers. As you can see, the cost to Alaskans is $82 million a year in order to financially, that liability for substantiated reports of child abuse. And I wish we had a magic answer in all of this. I mean, as you can see from the slide, we have an iceberg, which is far greater from below than it is above. You know, when we started with this, you know, we're not coming in here saying this is the answer, this is what you need to do, but it is one of those of these are some of these things to be considering when we're allocating money, because as Jared said, the devils are in the details in terms of finding out how to allocate money to best serve Alaskans. You know, there's when we ask what we can do, I think this is not as bleak as it actually, I mean, it is bleak in the sense that any child who is suffering with this is one too many, but healing is possible, and brains can be retrained and learned, and there's a lot of resilience that can be built up with children, and there are a lot of people in our communities who are protecting children. One of the things that the CJA has done is put together a mandatory reporter program. It is available on the Alaska, it's the OCS, Department of Health and Social Services website. We have some of these if anybody's interested, but this on a little card with, and I'm so technically, somebody's gonna roll their eyes. I would call it a zip drive, but it has the and Jared's laughing at me. But the mandatory training is on here, and you can just stick it into a computer. And so when it's asking what is Alaska CJA doing to help, we have drafted laws in the past and brought them to you guys. You guys have been really instrumental in addressing starvation, the serious physical abuse, the protection of child interviews at CACs. We did add coaches to the mandatory reporters. The multidisciplinary team guidelines for responding to child abuse cases in Alaska, rural trainings on child sexual abuse. In 2016, we had this incredible opportunity to join the BIA conference, a providers conference. We were invited to sit into areas, and we spent a lot of time just listening about how communities are solving their problems, and community members know best about what's going on in their communities, and these were tribal leaders who were able to identify what was going on and had their own really good ideas about how to sort of solve those problems. And that may be a really untapped resource of, it doesn't cost anything to call on community members in order to have them help.
So one of the things that I've tried really hard to do, Joanna, is to encourage those communities. One of the places they can be proactive that we have a hard time being proactive is to allow it's an overused word, but to get the word is empowerment that I'm going to try and dodge around, and that is to get people to speak up, mm-hmm. you know. But then when they do speak up, where do they go? And so that's why it has to be a community leadership issue, because if they're going to speak up, they better have somebody who's safe to go to.
Absolutely.
And those are the proactive things. The what we're doing on some of the multidisciplinary teams is reactive. And so what we can do in a community, I think, is going to be very important to have some people speak up. And I was listening at AFN last year when some people very boldly got up and spoke to the elders in no uncertain terms that was a cause of great consternation. But that kind of boldness has to happen. And I think I was not only pleased, but I was surprised that it happened at AFN. But it's important that those kind of things happen so that people know they can speak up, but then they got someplace to go. So those are the things that I've tried to encourage at a community level, while we still have to work at the how do we respond. So anyway, just you have these projects which are primarily responsive projects, but that's what we have to do.
And I thank you, Senator. I agree with you wholeheartedly, and it's the boldness and the bravery to share their stories like that. So I talked a little bit on it. We do have the reporting child abuse training on there. We do provide scholarships for the Child Maltreatment Conference, which is another conference that we're sponsoring. And then also coming and talking to you guys to provide whatever sort of information that we can to be of use. And I don't think that's me.
I don't know of anybody in the room that's an expert on child advocacy centers.
We actually have one of those for you.
I was being facetious.
Oh, I didn't know you could see her behind me.
Yes. Would you like to come talk to this, or do you want Joanna to continue on? They're commonly known as CACs, but in the world of acronyms, that's Child Advocacy Center.
That's correct. And this is Pam Carolunas, the chapter coordinator with the Child Advocacy Centers. And we now have 12 in the state. 6 of them are accredited, which is very exciting. And I think it's always interesting. I think a lot of times people think that kids that are seen at child advocacy centers, which is primarily sexual abuse, are older kids. Indeed, they're not. About a third of them are age 6 and under, and about a third of them are little boys. So I think that's just really interesting to keep in mind as we're looking at these issues. These are the numbers of kids seen since the first CAC opened in Alaska. Anchorage is the oldest CAC. That's a lot of kids. Now, not all of them were abused, but there was some concern, and so they came to a child-friendly environment, a neutral environment where everybody involved in investigation comes together, they've been trained, and they do a forensic interview of kids. So clearly the need is there. That doesn't actually have the total on it, but I do have the total somewhere. But we've seen a lot of kids in our state.
So, Pam, just a question that I have. Now that we've been doing this some years, there's no doubt that we have a little bit of a track record. What is the kind of the exit survey that we can talk about with youngsters? Healthier? Do we know anything that is going to give us an encouragement that these children having gone through this process, get into a better pathway?
Well, we haven't done any, Jared may correct me, we haven't done any specific Alaska research on, you know, outcomes from child advocacy mm-hmm. centers. But what we do know nationwide, and I have no reason to believe that it's any different here, is that if a family, a child and a caregiver go through the CAC, they are far more likely to follow up on services, to engage the child in mental health. Caregivers are more likely to be able to be supportive. There is substantial research out there that hasn't changed over the years that a supportive caregiver is the one most important part in the long-term outcome for the child. So, you know, you can kind of extrapolate from there. I would love to see some more significant research. And I would also like to say that I think one of the reasons you may have seen more violent crime compensation requests from rural Alaska is because the CACs, the advocates at the CACs, help those families complete the form. And the rural areas see fewer children, and they have more time to do that. Those forms are a little bit complicated. And so you really do need some help, especially if you're in crisis, which most caregivers are when they, you know, are just finding this out. So what I know from just working with our CACs is that the rural communities are much more likely to complete the forms. So I think what you may be seeing is somehow reflective of that.
Thank you. Jared?
Senator Cockhill, I can also speak to, I now, in the Division of Public Health where I'm at.
Put yourself on the record.
This is Jared Parrish. We now have data sharing agreements with, I think, 10 of the CACs where we can get identifiable data to integrate them into our systems now so that we can answer some of those questions. So I'm actually heartened and hopeful that by this time next year, I could actually be speaking to some outcomes. Pending I can get one of my tasks removed from my desk.
But Jared, for one of the reasons I'm asking the question is we hear on a regular basis that if you've been abused, chances are you're going to be an abuser. And so we hear that in the legislature often. We need to know if that's anecdotal or if that is something that we can – I do have a psychologist or a psychiatrist.
he's shaking his head yes. Or no?
No.
Do you want to come and give some testimony? Because those are questions that come before us on a regular basis, and the breaking the cycle of abuse and neglect certainly is something that the legislature, bipartisan-wise, they want to put their effort into solving as best we can. Put yourself on the record.
I'm Mike Hopper. I'm a psychologist from Fairbanks. I react to that only because I think abused kids get a bad rap. There is a cycle of abuse. If you're raised and nobody responds or nobody believes you when it comes out, yeah, the nightmare will just keep going on. At the same time, it's not fair to kids who are abused for that message to keep going out in the world.
Good point.
And it does go out. Boys who are sexually abused, which is one of my areas especially, mm-hmm. I warn their parents not to tell their teachers.
Interesting.
Because the teachers almost automatically look at that boy as a danger. And that's not fair to boys. Matter of fact, boys who have been sexually abused are no more. We don't actually have great statistics on it because they're not really noticed or not. The research on it is very limited. They don't report. It's not as obvious. But my experience working with them for the past 30 years is if they're found out and if they're helped, they're no more at risk for proceeding to abuse as adults than were as kids. The cycle is real. And that's just a given. The more you can intervene and the earlier you can intervene to support these families and these kids, the better chances you have of changing that cycle. But I just react when people talk about abused kids. Because the truth is, some of the greatest parents I know are former abused kids. And I've been in the field now 40 years, and I work with their grandkids. And I stand in awe at some of these people. They're better parents than I was. So I don't know what the dynamic is. There's a resilience is an interesting thing, and we have a lot to learn from the kids who survive abuse.
Thank you. I appreciate that. That's a point well taken, and I will take it to heart. My question, because of the advocacy centers have to deal with youngsters who are either thought to or have been sexually abused, what what help they get. And the CACs at least give them the respect to not be continually run through that system. So I think that's a traumatization that just doesn't have to happen.
Absolutely.
So I'm glad for that. It's just that I was wondering, how do we follow up to for that healthy, get your foot on the ground in a healthy way, you know?
Well, and Pam mentioned it, that families that do go through there, they walk into a resource center. It's not just a place where you're interviewed. They know the counselors. They know who to send people to. They know the family support system. So it's a kind of a one-stop shop, and it's a wonderful model, and it makes a huge difference in these families. Unfortunately, I have to say there's an awful lot of them don't get there. That's the other reality of this thing.
That is unfortunate, but true, yes.
Yeah.
We have one other person who wants to testify on that particular issue, so thank you, Doctor. Yeah. Appreciate it.
I just can't keep quiet. I'm Dr. B.J. Koops. I'm a pediatric intensivist. I worked in the child fatality review teams and the child death reviews. I helped get certification for trauma levels in the hospitals. I do a lot of stuff, but as far as CACs go, as a child abuse expert for 30 years, I've gone to court, I've testified, I take care of these kids, I see them every day. What the CAC offers for physicians and healthcare people is full service that I no longer have to do myself. And I'm freed up to take care of the kids in the ICU now. Mm-hmm. Because we have experts who are trained even better than me that are there. And as a result, in our physician community, PAs, nurse practitioner community, more people are willing to call OCS and say, I have a question. Because you had touched on this before, Senators, that maybe we're over-reporting. That's not my experience in the healthcare mm-hmm. profession. We don't like opening up that can of worms. And nobody likes to say to the parents and of their patients that we think you're doing something bad to their child. It's a horrible social terribleness. And the CACs are so expert at this that it's very easy for me to say there's a law, I have concerns. We'd like to investigate it. I want to get the right people to look at this. As far as I'm concerned, without the CACs, we'd have fewer reports, fewer cares, less services to our, excuse me, I'm all dry, less services to our kids. It's really, please give them tons of money.
Well, thank you. Just make sure we got your name on the record, because your exuberance, I think you said it rather rapidly, so.
Sorry, B.J. Koops.
Thank you, B.J.
M.D.
Thank you. Point well taken. And we're going to run out of time here in about 20 minutes, so.
Oh, we don't have 20 more minutes worth of stuff. One of the things that we are really focused on is also, this is Hannah Siebold again, and that we are trying to work as partners with other folks, Strengthening Family, the Citizens Review Panel, Alaska Mental Health Board, Children's Trust, the Resiliency Initiative, Covenant House. As a matter of fact, we had the Alaska Children's Trust and someone from the Resiliency Initiative speaking with us this morning, because I think we're all very like-minded in our goals of protecting children. And so we are trying to work collaboratively and have a good message, good sort of clear messages on that. What can you do? Realizing that this is affecting all of us in Alaska, and as I've said a couple of times, it's just making decisions using a trauma-informed lens. I've heard Dr. Mike Hopper say a lot that it's not what's wrong with you, it's what happened to you. And if you look at people through that vision, it's a lot less critical and it's a lot more problem-solving. We support a system-wide approaches to strengthening children and families.
Just to interrupt on that.
Of course.
As a society, we are definitely stigma-driven, I mean, in all kinds of ways. And so that's something we have to continually figure out how to work through. And I was glad to see this particular piece, because youngsters especially are susceptible to the stigma. Mm-hmm. So, and then once it gets on you, how you shake it, you know, it's just an amazing thing. So, yes, thank you. I'm glad this is in this discussion.
And supporting, as we talked about, the local community-based initiatives. There's the Strengthening Families, Rock Matsu, Mobilizing for Action through Planning and Partnership, Pathways to Hope, Family Wellness. These are just a handful of local community programs that are trying to solve the problems themselves and provide that support and that safe landing for children and families.
So just a question on this. Every week, somebody's thinking to themselves, what can I do to help, right? And how do they find a place to go to that says, I don't have to reinvent this. People are already trying to figure this out. How do I add, you know, my nonprofit potential to it? Is this task force a place to do it, or where would you suggest that you take this Wellness Warriors, for example? I was thinking when they first started, they were looking for who do we work with,
mm-hmm.
you know? And it took them a while to figure it out, I think.
Senator, I guess I guess there's a lot of places that can do this. I think you see a room full of people who all are a network of passing on that information. I think probably the CJA is a great place. If somebody were to come to you and say, where who do I contact, please send them to the CJA, because if we don't have a good, if the person who doesn't answer the phone has the answer, they will know somebody that they can direct that to.
I wanted to hear it because you will probably, every week somebody's asking, what can I do to help, whether they're a professional or a family member who got affected by something that they said, you know what, we got to find a solution to this, and they're going to go looking for people to help.
Senator Coghill, this is Jared Parrish. I know that the Alaska Children's Trust is really trying to be that centralized place by doing this collective impact model. The collective impact model has been really promoted by the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention as well, and that's how the Resiliency Initiative has risen and is trying to develop, and it's supporting these local communities like the Rock Matsu. Rock Matsu is a great example of this, and I think that we should be having the little bit of a lens on them, because they're engaging not just your traditional partners, but your private partners as well, which in health, we don't do a good job in doing that, especially when we're thinking about prevention. So I think that the Children's Trust is a great place for us to be directing people to, because they have their pulse on a lot of what's going on in their local communities.
So I think one of the...
Just for the record.
Oh, I'm sorry. This is Johanna Siebold for the record. Supporting, we've talked a lot about what can be done, supporting services such as special education, health care, mental health and substance abuse treatment, child protection, homeless services and shelters, the legal system and corrections are all, we're going to be paying for it one way or the other. And these are all programs that we know that if we can address these things can end up saving money in the long run. The Alaska data is suggesting that many Alaskans, adults, bear the burden of a lifetime accumulation of family violence and dysfunction. Alaskan children start accumulating these adverse events early in their life, and then multiple factors are contributing to this maltreatment. Systems must be in place at multiple points along development trajectories to respond efficiently and effectively, and our economy and our society is bearing the cost of that. To reduce this burden, we need prevention, treatment, early, effective, timely intervention. And that is, I think that's us. And that's where we sit.
Well, I appreciate it. What you've done is you've shown us that you're looking into it. Probably the place where you leave us lingering is the thing that us legislators try to do, and that is find a solution, you know. And prevention is part of the solution. There's no doubt about it. So intervention is something that probably we have a bigger tool of, because on the legal system and in many ways we can mandate. But once again, it's tough. I'm looking it over at my OCS people. They have a lot of mandates, but they're also in a world that is it's a triage world. You can only do what you can do. And so my heart goes out to them, because the society dishes out stuff faster than we can deal with it sometimes. Okay. And so it's easy for us to say, well, we solved it, we made a law, you know. It just doesn't work that way, I'm sorry to say. But you brought up some good stats, and so I'm greatly appreciative of that. Treatment options are things that we look at in a variety of ways. It sounds like our poverty index is the place where most of us are going to go. And right now, our budget for our health and social service world is state and federal dollars topping $2.5 billion for a population of people that says 700,000 people. That's just an amazing number. And we top the list of so many places that are just bad lists to be on, sexual abuse and those types of things. So in your task force, one of the things that you've been tasked to do is bring recommendations forward. So let me ask you, based on some of the stats you're getting, are you going to corral two recommendations that are statutory? Or are you going to do process recommendations? What are the kind of things that you think you'll gravitate to based on some of the things you've told us today?
Senator Coghill, I think this is actually one of our first days of meeting, and these are some questions that we're going to be asking ourselves as well. So I don't know that I have a definitive answer for you, but we would be happy to share some information from our meeting after we've met and kind of let you know where we've come down on that.
Well, I appreciate that, and we can have the doctor come up. PJ, come on up. And so all I'm just going to say is, you know, the legislature is solution-oriented and probably hungry for solutions in the time and life that we live. So, PJ, go ahead.
BJ Coops, MD, one of the docs.
Sorry, I even mislabeled. I said P as B.
So. BJ, Barbara Jean.
All right.
One of the reasons I'm here with the group is to find out what you think we need to do that we can help you with. So not only call the 1-800-CJA Task Force for questions and help in any of these issues, but if I happen to think process is a better way to go, but not everybody here does. Maybe we do need to go statute. Maybe, and I think there's no one answer, and redundancy is very important, actually. It's important to have more than one way of doing things. So what do you think?
Well, I like as organic as we can get it. Just like with our education system, we're talking about how do we go from the community up instead of from the legislature down. And so this is our first look at this, and so I'd say the prevention is going to be a community conversation. And if we do not have that community conversation in Alaska, it'll be, first of all, shame on us. And I know that previous governors have tried it, like the respect, but it goes further than that. It goes, if you do say something out loud, you have some place you can go. So there are some places that are doing safe houses and things like that. That's a community effort that needs to be encouraged. And then in our schools, probably the hope of a better community is something that's going to have to happen. And I know that some of the elders coming into the schools have been a big part of that, trying to give that sense of community. That's a burgeoning work that I think is important. But we have some places where abuse is still a quiet thing, and it's just not acceptable. That is not something the law can fix. And so as you work on what a community can do, I think that's going to be an important part. I think for me, I would just ask where our laws are barriers to good community facilitation. Help us understand that.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Any other input before they go? Senator Wilkowski?
Yeah, sure. Thank you for asking. Because I think we will take your concerns and your ideas very seriously. You know, you're all professionals in this area. I'm not, at least. So I'm looking, personally, I'm looking for, you know, if there's piece of legislation here or there, absolutely, bring those forward. But if there are systematic things, if there are, you know, significant changes, that are research-driven, I'd like to see those. That's just me personally. Like, if you think having pre-K, for example, would mandatory pre-K or, you know, state-funded pre-K, it's going to cost a few million dollars per year. But if that's going to cut child abuse down the line, I'd like to see that. And I know there are others who would like to see that. If there are other things like that, I know we had hearings in this committee several years ago on smart justice, and we heard some things on foster care. There were, you know, some dynamic things that were being done there. So if you have ideas like that, I'd say bring them forward to us, and let's talk. Let's think big on this. This is a big problem.
I'll just say ditto to that. I think him and I probably agree on that. When we were doing criminal justice reform, they reported to us in more than one way that if we could work with those at-risk population, we could probably waylay some of our criminal justice needs. So that is no doubt something that we'll have to pay attention to. And 33% as a piece of Alaska's youth is just not acceptable. So I don't know if we should accept it. It's just that we have to help those that are so affected. And some of these numbers I did not know, but I've been involved in trying to help the CACs. That's one, but that's preventative. I mean, that's not preventative. That's reactive. OCS is reactive, and preventative is what really has to happen. And many times I've thought I would leave the legislature, go back to my other professional work, because at least I know I could catch one child at a time, one family at a time. But here we are at the policy world trying to work with you, and I think probably where we have barriers, and if there's a policy that is absolutely going to be helpful, certainly we can debate about it. I don't have a problem debating with Senator Wilkowski, but at the same time, I don't mind working with him to solve some of those issues.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Awesome. Thank you very much.
Senator Gogol, this is Jared Farish. Just a quick comment on this. I think that's why we really stress this advocacy that CJA is doing too, because our goal and our task and our mission is really to focus on the reactive part. And it's kind of weird for me being a prevention person. They always call me the data guy because I provide data. You always keep coming back to, we got to prevent. But we also have to react, and we have to do all those things. And then that an appropriate reaction actually turns into prevention for that subsequent generation. And that, I think that's really why we've really tried to do more intensive partnerships with, like, the Children's Trust and be on the same page, as well as with legislation that's going to be coming forward and things, to make sure that all these different advocacy groups, we basically are think tanks that are working together to say, what are the barriers to legislation that's keeping us from effectively servicing kids? And I think as we've, over the past year, formed some of these partnerships, that actually led to our meeting with the Children's Trust this morning before we came in here to talk about the things that they're doing while they're down here. And I think that this working together thing is, you know, it's kind of the unintended good consequences of having budget issues, is where people start saying, how do we work together, squeeze our pennies and our resources? And so I think we're seeing that right now.
And this is Johanna Siebold again. Someone was whispering in my ear saying, you know, one of the things we did agree on as the CJA was the HCR2, which is the deals with the recognizing the science of ACEs and as a resolution, and that is something that we were on board with, and also Senate Bill 171. I know that the Facing Foster Care has specifically, some of the things we had discussed in there was their ability to have sibling contact when children have been adopted out, and there's confidentiality and all of that. So those were something that we know how valuable those sibling bonds are. So those were some things that the task force was in agreement with.
So some of the things that you're going to hear debated within the legislature, maybe even within your own task force, is when you do an intervention, you have to decide whose responsibility is what. And in the legislature, we also have that debate. And that is, we can facilitate people to accept responsibility, or we can accept the responsibility for them, which doesn't no real good. And so in our budgeting process, we debate about, is this program going to help? Does it lift people? Does it give them a platform to walk off of? Or does it bury them in a program? And those are struggles we're doing right now, because we're in a budget process asking, what's the effectiveness of it? And Senator Wilkowski brought up the data-driven. We're looking for success-driven models that will help us make those kind of decisions, because we could facilitate something that would be temporarily helpful, but absolutely the wrong thing to do. So Those are things we have to continually remind ourselves of, and of course we have that debate here too. Thank you very much for coming before the committee, and first of all, thank all of you for willing to put your brains together, put your heart, take your disciplines and your work to help Alaska make a better place, but you're putting your collective brains and history together to try to figure out how do we get some solutions. I wish you well in it. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
With that, we'll adjourn.